Okay, good afternoon. We're now starting with the first session of the last panel. Professor Jean-Sébastien Borghetti from the University of Paris. He's an expert on contracts and tort law. And today he's speaking on litigation on hepatitis B vaccination and multiple sclerosis disease in France. Thank you.
Thank you, Diego. So I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for this conference and for inviting me. The only thing I maybe wouldn't thank you about is having me talking at the time of the siesta on the last day. But I'm very grateful to those of you who made the effort to come despite the time. So apart from that, I'd like to start with two caveats. The first one is on the paper, which some of you might have found on the internet. It's really just a draft, so I'm very thankful to those who read it, especially Jane Stapleton, who made already a few comments, so thank you very much. But it's really just a draft, all the more so as the more I think about the subject, the less certain I am what I should think about it. So it's really, you know, offering some thoughts. The second caveat is that I'm afraid I'm going to talk about a subject on which French lawyers generally are quite illiterate. I mean that we have very little experience in French law of, let's say, toxic torts, to talk of something, to use an expression which obviously is quite commonly used in many countries, but which we don't even know of in France. Just to tell you, we've had quite a lot of blood transfusion cases in France starting in the 1990s, especially because we had a blood transfusion scandal at the end of the 1980s. But there was, in that litigation, there was no problem of scientific uncertainty. We had problems of causation, but no problem of scientific uncertainty. And then, now, since about 10 years, we do have DES cases coming up. But there again, there are no real problem of causation, of scientific uncertainty. We have problems of causation once again, but those are different problems. And then, of course, we do have asbestos, as unfortunately in nearly all countries, I think. But the government set up a compensation fund for asbestos victims maybe 10 years ago, and it's working quite well, and we don't really have problems about that. So the result of that is that we don't really know about what you call toxic torts, and so it also means we don't really have the concepts for the time being to face these problems. That's what I'm saying, that we're illiterate. For example, such a basic distinction to, I think, most of you, at least to common lawyers, between general and causation and specific causation is a distinction that we do not have in French law. Lawyers don't even know about that. So, I don't want to cite myself, but I just, you know, wrote about that in my PhD thesis, but I'm probably the only person in France who really, you know, wrote about that and used those terms. So just to give you an idea, and of course, nobody in France knows about the old Brad Hill. The only Brad we know about is probably Brad Pitt, but it's the only one. So this being said, I'd like to talk about, hepatitis B vaccination litigation. So you all know, of course, about hepatitis B, which is unfortunately a very common disease, but it's also most of the time a quite benign disease. I mean, it's not really a problem. It's only in certain cases that it can get nasty. But since the 1980s, as you know, there is a vaccine against hepatitis B, and vaccination is strongly recommended. But then cases have been observed in which the first symptoms of demyelinating diseases have appeared a very short time after vaccination against hepatitis B. So demyelinating diseases are, let's just say, nasty diseases. And there are several types of these diseases, and the most common type, at least in litigation, is, or in cases, is multiple sclerosis. So I'm just going to talk about multiple sclerosis because it's easier to say for a Frenchman than demyelinating diseases in English. So let's talk about multiple sclerosis. And so you have this coincidence in time in a certain number of cases between vaccination and the first symptoms of multiple sclerosis. And as most of you probably know, epidemiological studies have been carried out, and the conclusion of these studies, as far as I know, is that no link can be demonstrated, actually, between no significant link, statistical link, can be demonstrated between, well, hepatitis B vaccination and multiple sclerosis. So as far as epidemiologists are concerned, it's just a coincidence. It's not the sign of general causation, as we can put it. There's only actually one study going the other way, which concluded that there was actually a significant statistical correlation between between hepatitis B vaccination and multiple sclerosis. But this study has been criticized on methodological grounds. I couldn't tell you if those criticism is justified or not. But the fact is, it's been criticized, and it's the only study going that way. So from a scientific point of view, there's no general causation demonstrated between, hepatitis B vaccination and multiple sclerosis. Epidemiologists cannot say that there is no general causation, but so far it has not been demonstrated. Nevertheless, in France at least, many people, including of course plaintiffs, but not only plaintiffs, are just convinced that hepatitis B vaccination can be a cause of multiple sclerosis. And so a significant number of claims have been filed in France regarding, the relation between hepatitis B vaccination and multiple sclerosis since the end of the 1990s. So where it gets more complicated is that you've got several different legal bases for these claims in France. So I'm afraid I'll have to explain to you very shortly what these legal bases are. The first one is a compulsory vaccinations compensation scheme. We have a special compensation scheme for damage arising due to compulsory vaccinations. So this is, with a compensation fund. And we have compulsory vaccinations, not in many cases, but it happens, for example, for health workers. I mean, people who work in the health sector must get vaccination against a certain number of diseases, including hepatitis B. So they can resort to that compulsory vaccination compensation scheme. Then we have what we can call service accidents compensation. That is basically work accidents compensation for public sector workers. And they can ask for compensation for work-related damage. And it's the state which pays for that kind of damage. And then we have work accidents compensation. And the difference between service accidents compensation and work accidents compensation is that work accidents compensation is for private sector workers. So that's basically social security. And the fourth possible legal basis is product liability. So as you all know, there is a UPIN directive on the subject. And so claims brought on the basis of product liability are basically based on the directive rules and therefore directed against the producer of the vaccine, or the producers, because you have in France mainly two producers of hepatitis B vaccines. So claims have been brought on all these four grounds. But then another difficulty is linked to the fact that it's not always the same courts which are in charge of these claims. As you might know, there is in France a very sharp divide between private and public law. And this divide in substantive law goes along with a divide in courts. So we have administrative courts, which are in charge basically of public law questions, and civil courts, which are in charge of private law questions. And at the top of the administrative courts hierarchy, you have the Conseil d'État. And at the top of the civil courts hierarchy, you have the Cour de Cassation. Compulsory vaccination and service accidents litigation is on the administrative court side. And work accidents compensation and product liability litigation is on the, well, private law and civil court side. So we have all types of courts involved in these different types of claims. Also, a precision maybe at this stage about the question of the standard of proof, which has been talked about a lot since 2 or 3 days. We do not have in France, be it on the administrative court side or on the civil court side, we do not have standard of proof rules. We do have, of course, burden of proofs rule, but we do not have standard of proofs rule. And one reason why we don't have that, and actually I think we can't have that, is that the highest courts in both systems, that is the Conseil d'État on the one hand and the Cour de Cassation on the other hand, are only, as we say, judges of the law. That means they only deal with legal questions. They do not deal with facts, so they take facts as they are established by lower courts. And so they are not in a situation in which they can control the assessment of facts by the lower courts. So, I mean, we could have rules about the lower courts being obliged to judge on the balance of probabilities or beyond reasonable doubt, and actually we do have some in criminal matters. But in civil matters, even if we had such rules, there would be no means for the higher courts to control if these rules are in fact observed. So we don't have standard of proof rules. That's, I think, quite important to know before we proceed. And so now let me tell you how the claims, the hepatitis B vaccination-related claims, have fared before the various French courts. So let me start with the claims brought before the administrative courts. The first cases arrived before the Conseil d'État, that is the highest administrative court, in 2007. And as you probably know, decisions by French Superior Court are extremely terse. So it's usually no more than one page. And if you've never seen that, even if you don't read French, you can look at my paper at the end. Just for information, I put you a few decisions. Even if you don't understand them, it'll give you an impression on how it's written and how short it is. So all these decisions are very terse. And this is because the courts don't give their reasons. They basically say that is the law, that is the correct interpretation of the law, and they don't give the substantial reasons why it is so. But then, of course, there are reasons, and one way to try and find them is to look at the reports which are written for the cases, because before the Conseil d'État and the Cour de Cassation, you always have a magistrate, which is called the reporter, who is in charge of reporting on the case and suggesting a solution, and so he writes a report. And sometimes you can have access to these reports. And so with the Conseil d'État, it's quite easy, because if you want the report, you just can ask for it. You just write an email to the Conseil d'État, and you ask for the report, and they'll send it to you. So in those four cases which were tried before the Conseil d'État in 2007, we do have the report by the magistrate who wrote that report. And it's quite interesting, because the four cases, some were related to compulsory vaccination compensation scheme and the other two service accidents legislation. But basically, the question was the same. It was about causation. There was no difference based on the legal basis of the claim. And so the question was, did the vaccine cause multiple sclerosis in the case. And so the reporter wrote that, well, there was a state of scientific uncertainty, and he doesn't talk about general causation because he doesn't know the concept, but he says basically this: general causation is not proven, and scientists don't know. So they don't know if there can be general causation, but on the other hand, they haven't proven that there cannot be general causation. It's just an open issue. And quite mysteriously, he goes on to say, well, they don't know, but we can set a presumption, and the presumption will be, well, if no other cause for the disease than the vaccination can be identified, and if the first symptoms of the disease appeared in the within 3 months after vaccination, then it should be presumed that the disease was in fact caused by the vaccination. So, and he doesn't give reasons for that. I mean, he doesn't cite any, you know, medical studies or whatever. It's just, well, a presumption. And he was followed by the Conseil d'État. So the Conseil d'État ruled on the 4 cases using this rule. So in 2 cases, there were less than 3 months between the vaccination and the first symptom, so causation was affirmed. And in the 2 other cases, it was more than 3 months, so no causation. And so this has created a rule, and this rule has been applied by the Conseil d'État since that date, so you have about a dozen or so other cases, but which have followed this rule. So before administrative courts, things are clear. Of course, very questionable, but they are clear. And then you've got litigation before the civil courts. And there it gets a bit more complicated because we have one Cour de Cassation, but we've got several chambers, just like in Spain. And so work accidents litigation goes before one chamber, and product liability litigation goes before another chamber. So we actually have 2 chambers in charge of those cases. So let me start with the work accidents cases. There have been several such work accident cases related to hepatitis B vaccination, but only one case in which causation was really at stake, in which causation was really discussed. And in that case, the appellate court had decided that although there is no scientific certitude on the issue of general causation being not used as a concept because, once again, they don't know about that, but although there is this state of scientific uncertainty, the lower court decided that on the facts of the case, given the time proximity between, once again, between the vaccination and the first symptoms, causation should be regarded as established. And this came before the Cour de Cassation, and the Cour de Cassation said, well, you could decide as you did. I mean, you could, I mean, that was your decision on the facts of the case. I'm not, so I let it pass. So it was basically, it's not my business, it's your appreciation of the facts. So that's what the chamber in charge of work accidents litigation decided, and that was in 2006. And then let's turn to product liability cases. This has been the most interesting part of litigation in France. So the first cases came before the lower courts in the 1990s. And especially 2 cases were filed simultaneously before the same lower court. So they were tried simultaneously, and then it went to an appellate court. And the decisions of the appellate court on these 2 cases were quite interesting. The appellate court starts with that observation that there is a state of scientific uncertainty and that general causation has not been demonstrated. Once again, not talking about general causation, but that's the idea. So general causation not demonstrated. But then it goes on saying, so it has not been demonstrated that vaccination could cause multiple sclerosis, but on the other hand, it has not been demonstrated that it cannot cause multiple sclerosis. So we should actually presume that it has caused multiple sclerosis in these cases, and it's up to the producer to demonstrate that their vaccine did not cause multiple sclerosis. So of course, the producers couldn't do that. So the appellate court ruled for the claimants, for the plaintiffs. And so that came before the Cour de Cassation in 2003. And in 2003, the Cour de Cassation quashed these two rulings by the appellate courts. And so the ruling, as always, is very terse. But the reasoning seems to be as follows. If you can't establish, if you don't know the etiology of multiple sclerosis, and if general causation is not established, then you cannot establish specific causation in any particular case. So the two appellate court's decisions were quashed. So the Cour de Cassation doesn't talk about general causation in its decision because it just doesn't know the concept, as I've always said three or four times. But it comes very near to, it's really the idea, I think, behind a decision. It's really, if there's no general causation established, then you cannot have specific causation in any particular case. So you cannot, the plaintiff cannot win his case. That might seem common sense, but this decision was actually quite heavily criticized by quite a few doctrinal writers in France. One reason for that is that, as you probably know, French lawyers are sometimes very pro-plaintiff, or whether I should say pro-victims, and plaintiffs are very often seen as victims, even if all the elements of tort are not demonstrated. So, let's say pro-plaintiff academic writers, of course, criticized this decision, saying, here we have victims who didn't get compensated. Also, you have some writers, I think, especially of one colleague, who is really convinced, whatever the reasons, that, I mean, he's persuaded that really vaccination can cause multiple sclerosis. It's a matter of, call it religion if you want, but he's really sincere in thinking that. So he and other people sharply criticized the 2003 rulings. And of course, these rulings also came under attack after 2006 and 2007, especially after the Conseil d'État had set its own presumption, saying that if multiple sclerosis appears within 3 months after the vaccination, then causation should be affirmed. So people said, and that's quite obvious, how can you have the Conseil d'État saying, there can be causation and there actually must be causation in certain circumstances, and the Cour de Cassation saying, you can never have causation. So there was indeed a problem. And so there was a development in 2008. In 2008, you had new cases coming before the Cour de Cassation, also product liability cases. And in two of these cases, the lower courts had followed the 2003 rule. That is, they had said, in essence, no general causation. So causation between vaccination and multiple sclerosis in the case under scrutiny cannot be established. So the claims were rejected. And this came before the Cour de Cassation, and the Cour de Cassation quashed those two decisions, saying, you could not, I'm translating, you could not rule out causation using, I quote, a probabilistic approach based exclusively on the lack of scientific and statistical link between vaccination and the development of the disease. So basically, you cannot base your decision only on the absence of epidemiological evidence as to possible causation between or possible relation between vaccination and hepatitis B. So the fact that there is no established general causation is not a sufficient reason to rule out causation in the case under scrutiny. So you should use other elements. What these elements can be, of course, was not said, but the message was clear. You cannot just, ground your decision on the fact that there is no general causation established. You must find other reasons to ground your decision. So lower courts must basically judge on the facts of the case, which is, of course, natural, but they're not even allowed to say only no general causation, so no specific causation. They cannot do that. And so the result of that, as you might predict, is that in product liability cases, you now have well, let's say divergences. I mean, it flows in all directions. I mean, it's not because you have some lower courts saying, well, on the facts of the case, and usually they just have in mind the time coincidence between vaccination and the first symptoms. And so they say, given this time coincidence on the facts of the case, I decide that causation is established. And you have a few lower courts who follow that line. And when the first decisions by these lower courts came before the Cour de Cassation, and the Cour de Cassation affirmed, saying, well, you decided that on the facts of the case, there's nothing I can say, that's your decision, so, okay. Of course, all the poor plaintiff writers were very happy and said, well, that's great. But then, about 1 year later, you started having new cases coming before the Cour de Cassation. And those new cases were cases in which the lower courts had said, well, general causation is not established, and that's not a sufficient reason to say that causation is not established in the particular case. But then in the particular case, we see no other element on which we could ground establishment of causation, so no causation. And in some of these cases, actually, the time delay between vaccination and the first symptoms were very short. It could be 1 or 2 months. But those lower courts said that's not enough to regard causation as established. And of course, the Cour de Cassation didn't quash these rulings. It couldn't do so because the lower courts had done exactly what they should do according to the Cour de Cassation's position, that is, ruling on the facts of the case. And so now, French courts are divided. You have got a minority of courts who are ready, in product liability cases, who are ready to consider that, well, a short delay between vaccination and the first symptoms is a good reason to find causation in the particular case. And then you've got other courts, and actually a majority, who decide that, well, a short time between vaccination and the first symptoms is not a sufficient reason to find causation. And among the courts which hold this position, you find the Paris Appellate Court. And of course, most of the cases go through the Paris Appellate Court. So it means that actually, and even though it's not stated that way because they're not allowed to do so, the reasoning behind the Paris Appellate Court decision is quite clear. It's there is no general causation established, so you cannot have specific causation. So actually, the Paris Appellate Court is sticking to the 2003 Cour de Cassation's position, but only they're not saying that because they're not allowed to say that. But that's, I think, the basic idea behind that. So you see that, well, the state of case law is not really fully satisfying because you have, on the one hand, the Conseil d'Etat saying there's a rule. If the first symptoms appear within 3 months of vaccination, then causation should be regarded as established. And then you have the Cour de Cassation saying, well, it's not my business. It's the lower courts who must decide on the facts of the case. But they're not allowed to ground a decision only on the fact that general causation is not established. So now that I've, presented this situation, which admittedly is a bit awkward, I'd like to offer a few comments on that. The first reaction which you might have, and which at least was my reaction, would be to say, how can you regard specific causation as established in any particular case if it is not proved that general causation exists? So that was my reaction. And so in 2000, when I wrote my, doctorate thesis, it was in 2004, so just after the 2003 decisions, I clearly approved these decisions, which seemed to me common sense. Coming to think of it again, I'm not quite so sure that this position is as self-evident as it might seem. And so it's hard to explain, but we had a discussion with Jane Stapleton this morning about that, so I'll try to be clear. But I think that there can actually be cases in which it would be legitimate for a court to find that there is causation between the vaccination and hepatitis B without epidemiological evidence. Just to take an example, which was actually given by Jane Stapleton, if you make an injection of the vaccine to someone and immediately the symptoms appear, I mean, that wouldn't happen for multiple sclerosis, but let's just say that. You make an injection and immediately the person starts being sick. Then, I mean, you might have strong clinical evidence that there is a link between the two. And the point is, the reason why the vaccine caused multiple sclerosis in that case might not be because this vaccine can, as a rule, cause multiple sclerosis. It might actually be a manufacturing defect in that dose of the vaccine, which caused, in that case, multiple sclerosis. So if you find specific causation in that case, it does not necessarily mean that general causation does exist. So admittedly, that would not happen very often. I mean, that would be rather an exceptional case. But on a matter of principle, I can understand that you do not regard the establishment of general causation as a prerequisite to the establishment of specific causation. So, once again, on a matter of principle, I can understand the 2008 Cour de Cassation's position, saying you do not necessarily have to demonstrate general causation before you regard causation as established. But then, this being said, it is quite clear that the current state of French law is more than open to criticism, because, and the reason for that is quite obvious. It is that the elements which are used by French courts to regard causation as established in any particular case are not convincing at all. Because what are these arguments? If you look at the detail of French decisions, you will find three elements or three arguments which are used to justify those findings. The first element is that no other cause than the vaccination can be found to the disease. So the courts say, well, we could find no other cause to multiple sclerosis in that case than the vaccination. The problem is, we don't exactly know what the etiology of multiple sclerosis is. So if we don't exactly know what are the possible causes for multiple sclerosis, how can we say that in any particular case there is no other cause than the vaccination? It's quite clear that this is not convincing given the state of scientific knowledge on multiple sclerosis today. So this element, I think, is not at all convincing. The second argument which can be found in some decisions is basically the opinion of the plaintiff's general practitioner in the case. But that's only the GP's opinion, and nothing is said about, you know, the qualification of that general practitioner and on what grounds he regards causation as established. So that's not serious clinical evidence. It's only the opinion of a doctor, but we have no information as to the special qualification of this doctor or the elements which he uses. So this, again, I think, is not a convincing element. And then the third element which is used, and which I've already mentioned, is the time coincidence between the vaccination and the first symptoms. This, of course, is, let's say, disturbing. I very well understand that if you've got someone who develops the first symptoms, let's say 1 month after the vaccination, he will think that it was due to the vaccination. It seems to me quite natural as a reflex. But then the problem is that this element, that is time proximity, is precisely this element which epidemiologists say is not as such a proof. And actually, to consider that time proximity is a proof of causation rests on a presupposition, and the presupposition is that if vaccination causes multiple sclerosis, it will do so very quickly after the vaccination. But it could be very different. I mean, it could be that vaccination can cause multiple sclerosis, but that it will only happen 2 years later. And actually, the little evidence we have, as far as I can judge on the scientific literature I read, the little evidence we have goes rather in the direction that if there is general causation, well, then there should be a certain time between the vaccination and the first symptoms. So if indeed vaccination can cause multiple sclerosis, then multiple sclerosis should appear only 1 year or maybe 2 years after the vaccination. And if that is true, it means that if the first symptoms only appear 2 months after the vaccination, it's actually rather proof that these symptoms were not caused by the vaccination. So all this argument about time, you know, the time coincidence is not convincing at all, and it's not a scientific, I think, a serious scientific argument, or at least element. So it's quite clear to me that the position of those French courts which admit causation between vaccination and multiple sclerosis is not convincing, and I should say not convincing at all. And I would even say that to a certain extent it's rather funny. Let me explain myself. I think there's a point to make, which is that you might be, as I said previously, you might be able to demonstrate in a particular case causation between vaccination and multiple sclerosis without using epidemiological studies. So that might be a possibility. But the problem is that French courts, for the time being, are unable to do that. So the elements they use to justify the solutions are exactly those elements which epidemiologists say are not convincing. And so what French courts basically do is they say, well, scientists tell us that these elements are not proof of causation, but we judges know better than scientists, and we know that those elements which scientists have said are not convincing, well, these elements are proof of causation. So basically, we judges can beat scientists at science. It's quite ridiculous because they're substituting their own science for, you know, scientist science. So I'm not saying that legal decisions should be, so to say, subordinated in all cases to what scientists say, but you just can't say that you'll substitute your own, you know, pseudoscience for the science of scientists. So, well, the situation is clearly not convincing for the time being, and I think that in the current scientific context, the right position is the position which was the position taken by the Cour de Cassation in 2003, that is, in the current state of things. Since general causation cannot be established, we shouldn't admit that, in the absence of, for example, convincing clinical elements, we should not admit that specific causation be established in any particular case. And that is actually the position of the Paris Appellate Court. I would just, since I think I've got another 5 or 10 minutes, I would like to make another remark on that position of the Cour de Cassation. This applies only to product liability cases, not to work accidents or service accidents cases. But I think that this solution, this way of cheating on causation is really not a good idea, if only because causation is only one problem. The other obvious problem in product liability cases is, of course, defectiveness. And then the question comes, how do you demonstrate that the vaccine is defective? So some lower courts actually have managed to consider hepatitis B vaccine as defective on the basis of failure to warn, saying you should have warned of the possibility of causing multiple sclerosis, and you didn't do that, so there is failure to warn. Okay, I won't comment on that. But now, since maybe at least 10 years, all vaccines against hepatitis B say have a leaflet saying it may cause, in exceptional cases, multiple sclerosis. So now, well, I mean, you won't be able to use failure to warn anymore. So now, if you are to demonstrate effectiveness, you'll have to demonstrate a design defect. And how do you demonstrate a design defect in a drug? That's, of course, extremely difficult. And actually, we've got no case in France in which, at least since the directive, we've got no case in which the Cour de Cassation has regarded a design defect in the drug as established. And so we have very little authority. But most writers are of the opinion, and there is also authority in lower court's decision, most writers are of the opinion that for a drug, you can design, you can demonstrate design defects only by using a risk-benefit analysis. And if you do so, it's quite obvious that it's near to impossible to demonstrate that a vaccine, I mean, at least hepatitis B vaccine, is defective, if only because the benefits of the vaccine are, well, recognized, they're certain. And they're not only to the users of the vaccine, they're to the community at large, because of course, if I get vaccine, then it's also good news for you, because you've got fewer chances to get infected. So, I mean, the claimants will probably never be able to demonstrate defectiveness in the vaccine. So cheating on causation is not even a good idea for plaintiffs, because in the end, they won't get compensated. So, well, what's going to happen now? I don't know. It's quite obvious that French judges, I mean, probably like most judges, they don't like to admit that they're wrong. So it's rather unlikely that the Cour de Cassation will say tomorrow, well, we erred in 2008, and so we're going to come back to the 2003 position. So maybe if we have scientific developments, for example, new epidemiological studies which go one way or another, it will be a good reason for judges to say, well, now we know better, so we can decide. But if we have no such developments, then what can we do? Well, I guess it's, well, French author's job, basically my job and my colleague's job, to try and explain to French judges well, these difficult notions of general causation, specific causation, and try to give them a better understanding on how they should manage these toxic thoughts. But maybe I can just end saying that I was actually a bit, I mean, listening to common lawyers during these 2 days, I was actually a bit frightened because I'm very impressed at the amount of intelligent and, you know, efforts, time, and scholarship which has been invested in those toxic torts cases. And at the same time, it seems that, well, you still have lots of problems. So, I mean, all French decisions are really not convincing. I certainly am not defending them, but I'm just a bit frightened that you've gone so, I mean, you know so much better than we do, you know, on toxic torts, and you've got all that scholarship, all that thinking, and all that intelligence. So you're way ahead of us, and still the solutions you have are not always convincing. So all solutions are, to a large extent, very bad. But I don't know to what extent investing will he be rewarded? Because I don't know what really is the good solution. But, well, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Sebastian. Now we have 45 minutes for debate. Professor Kerenpass.
You mentioned the disclaimer, the recent disclaimer, might in rare cases cause the disease. So will claimants ever try to rely on this warranty of this disclaimer in order to say that there is causation?
Yeah, that's a problem. It's a bit vicious because some lower courts have said there is no warning so you're liable for failure to warn. And so, of course, so the producers have put the warnings. Well, actually, they've put the warnings for other reasons as well. But anyway, now they have the warnings. And so some lower courts say, well, you have the warning. That's proof for causation. Because if you warn, it's because then there can be causation. So, I mean, well. And, well, this hasn't come before the Cour de Cassation. There is one case which actually came before the Cour de Cassation. But it was a bit ambiguous, so that's what the lower court had said, and it was not quashed by the Cour de Cassation, but then that was not really the question which had been asked before the Cour de Cassation, so you can't really say that the Cour de Cassation is ready to accept this argument. But, well, of course, it shouldn't be accepted. But... Yeah. Well, I must say that maybe just to make the link with a larger problem, we're not, French law is not very clear on the issue of the different types of defectiveness that can exist. I mean, the basic distinction which is so well known in American law between, and not only in American law, but between manufacturing defects, design defects, and failure to warn, is not recognized as such in French law. If you analyze the cases, then it's quite clear that courts actually do distinguish those different cases because you just can't appreciate defectiveness in the same way in those different cases. But the distinction is not recognized as such. And so the relations between, for example, failure to warn and design defects are not always very clear in the cases because the courts do not have this conceptual framework in mind. So I think it's coming because some authors are suggesting that we should use that, but it's not yet, let's say, even common knowledge. So.
Professor Stapleton?
I've got 3 points. The first point really takes off, just comment on your last point. Yes, the fact that we common lawyers have been spending an awful lot of time on this and haven't really turned up very much useful might just reflect how we're all waiting for the civil lawyer and help us here. So we're looking forward to that. So I've got 2 points. The first is really a question about, I guess, procedure, because you said at one point that there's this block now that the lower courts get to do it. They've got to do it on the facts. And so there's this sort of almost block to appealing up to the Cour de Cassation. So am I right that there's therefore no appealability about the credibility of the evidence on which those lower courts are deciding the facts?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, so that's amazing.
Yeah, it's not stated in those terms, but it's basically lower judges intimate conviction on the nature of facts and their well more or less convincing character, and the Cour de Cassation or the Conseil d'État can exert no control on that on the judgment of the facts. So
if I'm a lower court in France, I can just say, well, I think, for whatever religious reasons in my head, that 2 and 2 = 5, and that's a fact, and that's not appealable, even though the grounds on which I reached this are deplorable?
Well, it's an interesting question. It would be appealable. I think, but then I think the Cour de Cassation would have to say you cannot have such a finding because such a finding is contrary to, well, to rule. It's not really legal rule, but it's contrary to what we know. which is basically what it did in 2003, saying you cannot find this fact because it contradicts what we know of the science of reality. So that's actually what the Cour de Cassation said in 2003. So it can do it. Right. But what it did in 2008 was saying, I won't use this
power.
This power anymore on that.
But nevertheless, it could revive that 2003 supervisory control if it wanted to.
Oh yeah, it certainly could do so, and it would have the power, for example, to use the notion of general causation and to say mm-hmm. you can only prove specific causation if general causation is established. It could do that. Mm-hmm. The only thing it did in 2008 was relinquish this power and say, I won't control that anymore. But it could gain that power back.
Okay.
It could do that.
And my last point is, I was a little at odds with you when you were talking about defectiveness, post-relicensing defectiveness, because if the norm of defectiveness is going to be cost benefits, then post-licensing benefits might remain static, but the cost profile will change according to what you learn about how badly the drug does. And we all know that even after licensing, and licensing may have not been negligent, but we learn that, gosh, you know, the children of the women who take this drug have awful things happen to them. So the cost benefit profile shifts, and therefore I think you can find that even though a product may, at the time it was licensed, is not defective, it becomes a defective product once we recognize what the cost profile is.
Yeah. I fully agree on that point. I didn't develop that point because I was a bit short on time, but generally speaking, I fully agree with you. My opinion in the particular case of hepatitis B vaccine is that it is not defective on a cost-benefit analysis because the benefits of the vaccination are clear. And as far as we can judge now, even if there were to be a possibility that hepatitis B vaccine causes multiple sclerosis, the benefits of the vaccination are such that on a cost-benefit analysis, the vaccine is still not defective. So it seems to me that in the particular case of hepatitis B vaccine, it would not be possible, given the facts we have today, to consider that it is defective. But that doesn't preclude the possibility that for some other drugs, even though they were licensed, they can be regarded as defective.
But we might, according to what you say about the evidence of how MS might have a latency period, we might get really good data soon that, I don't know when they started vaccinating, but say they did it 10, when did they start vaccinating? 10 years ago?
The vaccine dates back to 1982, I think.
Okay.
And we had massive vaccinations, at least in France, starting in the 1990s.
Okay, so let's say we discover that the vaccine causes cancer with a 30-year latency. Then, it's possible that it's a defective drug, but that's a moving target.
Yeah, of course. I was just saying, if we only reason in terms of multiple sclerosis, and even if the case which are argued to be related to the vaccine were indeed caused by the vaccine, it probably wouldn't be sufficient to regard the vaccine as defective. but then maybe, as you say, it might
prove
another disease.
Given the numbers we now know, yeah.
Yeah, so the theoretical possibility that it is defective is of course exists. Yeah, I totally agree.
Professor Sanders?
I'm tempted to go off on the products liability issues, but I'll let them pass. They're intriguing. I'm more interested in, obviously, these causation issues. But let me just say, first of all, I don't think in the United States that even under this circumstance that the drug company could possibly put on its label a warning against multiple sclerosis based on these opinions in the absence of significant scientific evidence demonstrating a relationship. If it tried to do so, I believe the FDA would tell them they could not change their label in that way and could not put that on, which is interesting because it really ties causation to a breach at a different level. So what happened to try to avoid this? I don't think it happened, but that's just a comment. More generally, I think this is the status of the law in the United States, just to brief summary, because I do a chapter on this every year, so I read every damn case. You must have general causation proven before you can even argue specific causation. Expert witnesses who want to argue specific causation in the absence of proof of general causation are prevented from testimony under Daubert. They can't even testify. So at least the expert evidence on specific causation, unlike the testimony of the victim, would simply be inadmissible. And in these cases, because the courts would say you cannot prove your case in the absence of expert testimony, the testimony of the victim would simply be irrelevant, would be insufficient to carry the day, and the case wouldn't go forward. There are a handful of cases to the contrary, but in my opinion, they've become fewer and fewer in number and less persuasive. The general causation before specific causation is uniform. I would have this caveat. When the courts say that, they're talking about the issues conceptually, not the issues as matters of proof. And so the discussion you had with Jane earlier, I understood to be the fact that epidemiology is not necessarily necessary to prove general causation. And indeed, in some circumstances, an effect can so immediately and so obviously follow a cause that almost no evidence at all is necessary to prove general causation. But in the latency cases, that's not true. So we just always have to have general before latent. And here's the other appointment I would make about American law in this area. Almost all the cases, not all because it's tricky when it gets to be immediately afterwards, but almost all the cases where there's a latency period like 2 or 3 years would say that an expert who's purporting to testify about specific causation based simply upon what is commonly called temporal order, i.e. you took the product and then later you were sick, they would simply say that that evidence itself is inadmissible on Daubert grounds, and you have to have something more than mere temporal order in order to have your testimony admitted. And I would say the overwhelming majority of cases say that as well. So I don't think there's any chance that these cases could prevail in the United States. And I don't know if there are any cases like this. Do you, Mike? None. For all the reasons I just sort of elaborated.
Well, I'm not quite surprised. I mean, to me, the surprise is that they did prevail in France. And I don't have sufficient knowledge of the various legal systems to know what's the solutions in different countries, but at least I'm not saying that the cases should prevail. I think that...
No, I didn't think you were. No, I didn't mean to suggest
but, I mean,
you were.
I do find the state of well, from my French point of view, let's say that the state of American law as you describe it is, I find, very rigid on that point. But nevertheless, the end result on the cases of hepatitis B vaccination seems to me to be quite reasonable. I just...
Let's follow the turns, please. Professor Green?
Well, I'm actually delighted that the French tort system has taken over as the international whipping post for profligacy and giving away money, because we readily are willing to yield that title to France. This is good news. Let me go back to your last point and Jane's comment about having civil lawyers help us out. I would say the problem is not law. I would say the scientists. If they would just resolve all the damn uncertainty, we'd be just fine. It's their fault, not ours. And just a question. Your reference to drugs and design defects and using risk-benefit, I thought that the EU directive was about consumer expectations, And I would have thought that once they put that warning on, that's the end of it, right, with regard to consumer expectations. My understanding, obviously, is incorrect, so help me.
Anything you need to know on the directive is in Jane's book, so that's the best reference I can give you. But I think the consumer expectation test in the directive is misleading because, I mean, the Europeans are no more intelligent than the Americans, for one thing. So if you couldn't figure out how it works, I don't see how we could figure it out. And then what is very interesting is that some countries, for example, Germany, had this distinction between the three types of defect: manufacturing defect, design defects, and failure to warn, which actually was imported from the United States. And what is very interesting is that the directive doesn't make any distinction between the different types of defects. But Germany has maintained the distinction, and especially on the issue of the development risk defense, the German Supreme Court has decided that the defense doesn't apply to manufacturing defects. And you don't have that in the directive, because the defense applies generally. And the German Bundesgerichtshof decided that, well, it did apply, but not to manufacturing defects. So just to give you an example on how consumer expectations, or let's say the language of the directive, actually plays as, like a cloth that you put on, you know, pre-existing law, which actually continues. So typically in France, we have, well, very little case law on the issue of defectiveness, but I cannot think of a case of where we really used consumer expectations. Although the courts can be, as I said, very pro-plaintiff, but they just don't use consumer expectations. And my theory, at least in France, is that when judges have to establish defectiveness, they basically make a comparison. They look at a comparable product and try to find if the product they have, they're judging, is defective in comparison to the other product. That's what they do. So it's not a matter of consumer expectations.
So as a plaintiff in France, I could not make an appeal to the judge that this product violates consumer expectations.
You could make an appeal to the judge. You could do that, but and maybe the judge would word his ruling in terms of consumer expectations, but I don't really see how it could really, you know, answer the question using only consumer expectations. And also, the directive actually doesn't talk of consumer expectations. The Westertals talk about consumer expectations, but the directive itself speaks of the security which can, safety that can...
The safety expectation you are entitled
to expect.
So let me just ask, I buy a ladder, and I'm up on the third from the top ladder, and all of a sudden the rung that I'm on breaks, and then I fall down to the next rung. It breaks, and I keep on going down, and the two sides of the ladder fall apart, and I land in a heap on the ground, okay? And I say to the judge, golly, I don't know if that's a manufacturing defect. I don't know if it's a design defect. But do you really care? Isn't it plain that this violates the expectations I'm entitled to have about ladders?
I think the judge's answer will be yes, but his reasoning, whatever the way in which he words it, his reasoning will be, well, if you take a normal ladder and climb on the ladder, it just won't break that way. So if there's no, you know, no evidence that you used it in a abnormal way, then he will find defectiveness, but he will do so Well, on the basis of legitimate expectations, but what is the basis, well, what is the ground of these legitimate expectations? Well, it's a normal product of that kind. I think that's the way he thinks.
Professor Stapleton?
And if I just may add a point, I think that's actually the problem we have with drugs, is that with drugs you do not have, very often you cannot make a comparison. So that's why we must find something else. Because for most products, you don't have that problem. And so drugs are really specific. I mean, it's been written many times. But just.
So I'll take on this. Right at the beginning when the directive came out, Lord Mackay actually published an article with colleagues in the States where they made this point that the only workable standard would be cost-benefit. But what's really important is the wording of the directive does not say consumer expectations. It says the safety that you are entitled to expect, and what Lord Mackay and everyone else, well, people like me, that what you're entitled to expect is a matter of law, and the only workable standard is cost-benefit, so that's what you're entitled to. So even if you could get a mob of people to think, I don't expect any drug ever to cause me a side effect, that wouldn't govern. What is the standard you're entitled to expect is something else. It's cost-benefit.
Maybe just to react on that, it's quite clear that in France it is, or would be, because we don't have many cases, but it is a matter of law. I mean, the Cour de Cassation would have its word to say on the finding on defectiveness, which means it is a matter of law. If it was only a matter of consumer expectation of sociological observation, yep, then it couldn't say anything. I mean, the lower judges could say, well, it is all conclusion that consumers think that or that, and the Cour de Cassation couldn't say anything. But it's quite clear that the Cour de Cassation does control the findings on defectiveness. It's really a legal notion. And legitimate expectations are a legal notion, I mean, as you said.
The point I wanted to make was following Job, that I think we've got to be very careful that we don't just say, amplifying what I was saying to Jean-Sébastien before, about you could have specific causation without generic or general causation. Here's an example. Every time you give a batch of, a flu vaccine, a week later, these people went blind. Okay. Now, we would have specific causation in that case because it's so clear. But it's not generic in the sense that the entire design of that flu vaccine is related to blindness. We had a hot batch. We had a manufacturing error. So I think we've got to be very careful we don't say that you can never have the two together, because you have to accommodate the hot batch phenomenon.
Sorry. Okay. Professor Sanders, okay.
I don't disagree with that. I consider that in a stiff...
Of course, it's in the
manufacturing defect pile. Manufacturing defects, just like design defects, in the no general causation evidence. The very facts that prove these others are both. That's a minor point.
Professor Wright.
Yeah, I was going to originally just come in to kind of point out the directive is the safety you're entitled to. But I think that, to correct that, what has been deemed in the U.S. courts and in the restatement, and I think it's not just an overall cost-benefit sort of test, it's a risk-utility test from the consumer standpoint. So it's what the Connecticut court calls a modified consumer expectations test. So the restatement says that, we don't take into account the profit to the manufacturer, we don't take account the impact on the local economy, we take in the benefits and cost to the consumer, including price, but we take into account it's a consumer-oriented risk utility test. That, you know, what's the sort of risk that the consumer will be willing to undergo for certain benefits, and that if you tried to reduce the risk anymore, those benefits would be lost. And I was proud I got that language into the restatement third at one of the very first advisory committee meetings.
Just on maybe on this cost-benefit idea, it's we have lower courts authority in France for drugs as to the assessment of effectiveness, and those lower courts have used cost-benefit analysis or risk-benefit analysis for drugs outside the context of drugs. It's quite clear that French courts would not use that cost-benefit language, even, you know, consumer-oriented. That would be, as I said, a comparison. And, well, you might say that there's cost-benefit analysis behind it, but that's certainly not the criterion which we would use. But I was just to reflect on French law so that you know.
It sounds like you don't go into the cost and benefits at all, really.
No, well,
just a pure comparison with other. But what if it's a new product or it's a new drug?
Well, I think that the courts may do that. Well, you know, without knowing it. I mean, there's an interesting case. It was an escalator, and that was in the 1970s, and a child got his foot stuck between the escalator and the wall, and he got hurt, and. The Cour de Cassation said, well, here it was not on basis of product liability because there was no official product liability at that time, no regime, but liability was based nevertheless on defectiveness. And the Cour de Cassation said, well, here the escalator was defective because you could easily have designed an escalator without this kind of hole between the escalator and the wall. You could have done that, and that was, so to say, reasonable. So that was, in my opinion, it's really the, you know, reasonable alternative design. But they haven't, of course, they haven't worded it that way. But that's the idea. So, yeah, they can do that, but they won't think explicitly in those terms.
Professor Graham.
So, if I'm taking a drug, a cholesterol controlled drug, for which there's 12 of them on the market, and I suffer an adverse effect from the drug I'm taking, although it's warned about, I could try and convince a French judge that the benefit to cost ratio of that drug is less than others of the same class, and established effectiveness on that basis.
Oh, you certainly could try to do so. I mean,
could I succeed in convincing a judge of that?
Well, as a matter of principle, yeah, I don't see why you couldn't. I think that in practice it would be extremely hard, but yes, in theory, I think you could. Not that there's no legal rule, at least in French law, which bars you from doing that.
And why do you think I would have trouble doing so? I mean, there often are different benefit to risk ratios for different, same class, but different drugs.
Yeah. Well, that's a question which has not been addressed by French courts. So I'm only speaking on my, let's say, on my own authority, if there's any such thing. But I think it seems to me that a problem with drugs is that you can use different drugs to the same effect, although they have different formulas. So, I mean, if you have drugs which have the same formula, then probably they'll have the same side effects. So, well, not always, but sometimes. Well, we have some cases in France. So, same side effects. So, if one is defectively designed, then the other is as well. So you can compare the two to say that one is defective and not the other. And then if these are two drugs which have totally different formulas but which are used in certain cases for the same disease, then can you compare them? I personally do not think that the comparison is valid because they were not, you know, designed for the same, let's say, for the same function. It happens that they may be used for the same pathology, but initially they were not intended for the same thing. So I personally don't think that you could judge defectiveness only on the basis of a comparison between these two drugs. This doesn't mean that you cannot prove that one of these drugs is defective, because taking the drug itself, you might be able to demonstrate that its benefits are not as high as its risks. That's possible, but comparison as such would not be sufficient, I think.
But we would when it came to ladders.
We would when it came to?
We would compare the ladder I described with other ladders that are on the market.
Yeah, we would do that, but the question is, can you really compare the two products? So, well, if it's ladders, of course, it's a question of fact, you know, whether the two ladders are really comparable. That might not be the fact, but usually with not, so to say, normal products, you can find comparable products. The question with drugs is, do you really have a comparable product, which is not exactly the same formula? That's, I think, a very practical problem. And very often you won't have a comparable drug which is really comparable, but which is not exactly the same drug. Because, for example, if you take DES, that was, as far as I know, exactly the same product. You had two different names, but it was exactly the same product. So you can just, I mean, either they're both defectively designed or none of them is, but you can't compare them to say that one is defective.
For DES, yes. There are multiple drugs of similar but slightly different chemical composition for example, to control cholesterol. Yeah. And they have somewhat different risk to benefit ratios. But not dramatically different, but somewhat different.
Well, I think in that case, it could be, yes, that you compare them and say that one is defective. For example, if you take the original drug and a generic drug, it might be possible that, although the formula is the same, the adjuvants, or I don't know how you call that, additives are not the same. And, well, you might have a design defect which is actually linked to the additive you used. So in that case, yeah, you can make the comparison and say this one is defectively designed and that is actually due to the additive.
Right. So yeah. That's where we actually have changed the design, right? We had a terrible episode in the 1930s. It was called Elixir of Sulfanilamide. And the active ingredient was fine, but it was suspended in ethylene glycol, which is poisonous and killed several hundred children before we realized the problem was what it was suspended in to make it liquid. But that's a clear design defect. That's easy, right? Because we've actually, there's an aspect to it that we could do differently.
Yeah.
Okay, we have only 7 minutes, so... Professor Wright, us.
Actually, given that last example, I just began to worry. You know, if the French relied primarily on comparing to similar products, that can't be that all the time, even for long existing products. Or else, for example, Mike's example just now would not fail because comparable products use ethylene glycol, you know? So, I mean, if you have some product which is a bad design, but everybody who manufactures it uses the bad design, and maybe it made more profit doing that, right? But it could be made safer. So unless the court says, I'm willing to compare with a hypothetical design, which is clearly feasible and better, which is the way it's done, I suppose, right? The feasible alternative design. But if the court's only going to compare with existing products, then all sorts of bad products will never be improved and never found defective. So they must go further than that. They must kind of compare with, you know, sort of, if there's an argument here, here's a way, even though this is the same as every other product out here, they all these ladders break the same way, that, you know, there's clearly a better design.
Yes, of course. The comparison, anyway, is not an articulated criterion. Courts do not say we are comparing, and we are saying that there is defectiveness because we compared. They're not doing that. What I'm saying is that's the way, in fact, they're proceeding. But then it's clear that sometimes that they're ready to compare with a non-existing product, but which is a feasible alternative design, as is the in the case of the escalator. I think that in that escalator case, they could also have compared to existing escalators, because not all escalators do that. But they didn't even do that. They just said, well, it was fairly easy to design an escalator without that. So yes, they are perfectly ready to compare to a feasible alternative design. But, well, they don't articulate the criterion, but that's what they do, I think.
Okay, we have 2 minutes for the last round. So, Professor Sanders, just a quick punch. No? Okay. That's it. So we can have 15, maybe 20 minutes for a coffee break, because we're a little behind and we have to finish, okay? Thank you, Professor Borghetti. Thank you.